What's up, everyone? Welcome back to Untangling Climate Finance. I'm Jay Tipton. In this episode, I'll be talking to a very interesting fella, Nate Truitt at the American Forest Foundation. In our conversation, we cover topics like forest carbon credit projects, a new VERA methodology, and a first-of-its-kind green bond. I'm amped for this conversation because this year marks a historical landmark in the green bond space. For the first time ever, more money was raised from the sale of green bonds than from the sale of bonds tied to oil, gas, and coal. In the first half of the year, around $350 billion was issued from green bonds versus $235 billion for dirty fossil fuels. That's a difference of about $115 billion. Absolutely massive. This is also a huge improvement when looking back just a few years ago to 2020, when green bond issuances were completely blown out of the water by fossil fuel bonds. The numbers then were nearly a 1-to-4 ratio, with green bonds bringing in around $137 billion and the dirty stuff bringing in a little bit over $430 billion. Now, whether this optimistic trend continues throughout the rest of 2023 and beyond is yet to be seen. But for now, the numbers are a win for the climate. But enough of this number mumbo jumbo. Let's jump into the conversation with Nate. Nate, welcome to the episode.
Hi, thank you.
This is the speed dating portion of the conversation, Nate. I would love if you can tell me a little bit about yourself, where you're from, where you're living, some of your background, and then what I'd really like to hear also is your career pathway to where you are now at AFF.
Okay, yeah, sure. So my name is Nathan Truitt. I tend to go by Nate or Nathan. I live in Alexandria, Virginia, and I work in DC out of the office of the American Forest Foundation. My background, I was in college, I was an English and a classics major. And like every good English major, my future plan was to write the great American novel. While I was waiting around for inspiration, I stumbled across a recruiting booth for the Peace Corps. And I ended up going into the Peace Corps to Turkmenistan for 2 years and then liked it so much I extended for a third. I then got a job in Central Asia with an international NGO that did international educational exchange programs in Uzbekistan. So I spent a couple of years there. I met my wife there, kind of flitted around Eurasia, Ukraine a little bit, Balkans, and then came back to the United States to work for that same company, but in a fundraising capacity. Mm-hmm. And so most of my professional background from then until now has been in what I would call fund development. So soliciting donors for funds to advance some charitable mission of the organizations I've been working for. Doing that in an international context was really difficult because of the travel requirements. So I would have to leave my wife and our young children for 2-3 weeks at a time. Mm-hmm. And so a big passion of mine that comes from my own upbringing and my family, who were big into the outdoors and outward bound and wilderness adventure and exploration, was environmental conservation. So I made that switch about 12 years ago, and 10 years ago came to the American Forest Foundation, where my job was as a fundraiser. And through that process across basically a decade, I came to realize that two things really. Conservation organizations were not producing the outcomes that people actually wanted from conservation attempts. This is things like beneficial climate outcomes, positive biodiversity outcomes, clean water, resilience, the ability to avoid catastrophic wildfire, these sorts of very clear things that the communities and donors wanted. What instead the conservation community was producing was a lot of very well-intentioned activities, mm-hmm. right, that were kind of aimed at those outcomes, but we actually didn't know if those outcomes were being produced or not. And I detected from a lot of the donors that I was working with, many of whom were companies, that they would be willing to invest a much greater scale of funds if those outcomes could be verified in some way, and if they were aligned with a company's own goals and targets. And of course, the best example of this is climate outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so that got me then into the world of, okay, how do you create a carbon credit? How do you sell it? Given that you can only sell a carbon credit after you created it, and given that that happens years down the road, now we need to finance it, right? And so I ended up talking to Sean Penrith of Gordian Knot about these things and sort of learning as I went. And so at this point, I would not in any way say that I am a finance expert or a market expert. I'm still new to all those things, but I think that the experience I've had, the background that I have, does sometimes allow me to bring a new perspective to those conversations. And then I'm able to more readily translate those concepts to the realities of a nonprofit conservation organization.
That was great. And I would totally agree with you that your background probably does lend itself to a more interesting perspective, or at least a fresh perspective when it comes to dealing with finance. You've worked in many other parts of the world. When you're doing that, you kind of get a little bit more sense of the humanity side of things, especially when it's in relation to nature. So I would totally agree with that. In this space, I think that that type of experience is very, very essential. But before we move on to AFF and what the organization is doing, I do want to circle back, because you gave me an absolute layup to ask you this question when you talked about the personal stuff, which was to write the next great American novel. I have to ask, who is your favorite American novelist?
Favorite American novelist. So I ended up gravitating a lot towards English novelists. My favorite was probably Thomas Hardy. My favorite book is Catch-22. And I did write not one, but two novels.
Kudos.
And they both are like really, really terrible attempts at mimicking Catch-22. So, but I at least tried.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't have the regret. I don't think like, if I only tried, I could have written the great American novel. Nope, I tried it. I failed miserably and I moved on to other things.
Yeah, let's move on to saving great American forests. How about that?
There we go.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about AFF? What does the organization do? And then I also know your Flagstaff program is the Family Forest Carbon Program, the FFCP. So start with AFF, and then if you can, work into FFCP.
Yeah. So the American Forest Foundation is this really fascinating organization that has a very unique mission, and that is to work with the nation's family and individual landowners to give them the education, the technical knowledge, and sometimes the financial resources they need to manage their lands in a way that produces outcomes that the entire society cares about. And this is a really important mission because about 40% of forests in the United States are owned by families and individuals, not by companies, not by federal and state governments. So it's a huge area. Actually, if you add them all up, it's equal to the size of the state of Texas plus the state of California. So that gives you a sense of the scale. But the problem is it's divided into all these little tiny chunks, right? Think 100 acres. And for listeners of this podcast who are like, what's an acre? You know, this is one of the things the conservation community always just assumes people know. Think of a football field. That's basically an acre. And so if you have millions of people who own these like football, you know, 100 football fields worth of forests, but that's not their job. They have other jobs. That is something they inherited. It's maybe something they bought as a place to recreate. It's not what they think about all day. And so if you want them to manage it in a way that's informed by the best science, you really have to do a lot of thinking about how do you design programs that give them support to make those right decisions. Mm-hmm. So that's the mission of AFF. In some form or fashion, it's existed since the 1940s. And it's been working on a very broad array of issues. The Family Forest Carbon Program came into being in 2018 through a partnership with the Nature Conservancy. And it's really the product of two different things that were happening at the time. The first, everyone listening to this podcast will be aware of, was the accelerating ambition on climate on the part of countries around the world, but also companies. And in particular, the development of a voluntary carbon market that was going to be more robust, more rigorous, and way bigger than anything we had seen before. So it was clear looking at that carbon market was a potential source of funding to provide those landowners with that assistance that I just talked about them needing,
yeah.
Right? So that was interesting. At the same time, we had, as AFF, we had done a lot of analysis on our ongoing efforts. And what we discovered was we were really good at talking to landowners. We were really good at finding landowners. We were really good at getting landowners interested in conservation outcomes. We were really good at connecting landowners to organizations or professionals who could help them understand how to get those conservation outcomes. But despite all of that, there was actually relatively little that was changing on the ground. And that's just because changes in management cost something.
Right.
Right. I mean, there's a cost. It's either direct. Think of planting a tree. You have to pay for the seedling. You have to pay for someone to plant it. You have to pay to take care of it. Or it's an opportunity cost, something that you're not doing. For example, if you forego a certain kind of timber harvest, which will give you a lot of money,
right,
in exchange for a lighter timber harvest, which will give you less money, but will provide you important benefits over the long term. Okay, you know, that's a hole in someone's pocketbook that we just created. And so we needed to find a way to fill those gaps, to provide financing to enable action. And so those two things, the voluntary carbon market seemed to us to be a great source of that.
Right.
And so we launched the Family Forest Carbon Program with that goal of aligning the voluntary carbon market with meaningful conservation outcomes on the ground, on family and individual lands that produce, yes, climate mitigation, but also a whole host of other benefits related to biodiversity or clean water or healthy rural economies, so on and so forth.
The excellent co-benefits that come along with a healthy forest that maybe don't exactly have the direct price tag on them. But yeah, so this is great. This is actually a nice segue into what I was hoping to be our topic for the day related to climate finance, and that's green bonds. And I know that almost exactly a year ago, July of last year, AFF and the Nature Conservancy launched a green bond valued at $10 million. And while green bonds themselves are not such a novel financial instrument, this bond was groundbreaking in its design and its approach. And what set this AFF green bond apart was its innovative strategy of essentially securing it through the pre-sale of carbon credits that were yet to be generated. So I understand that this concept is likely going to be unfamiliar to some of our listeners. So what I'd love is if you could actually break it down for us in a little bit of a more easy to understand explanation.
Yeah, I can certainly try. And I think you summed it up pretty well. What we were able to do is we were able to validate a core part of the hypothesis for the business, essentially, which is that we could sell carbon credits from family lands at significant volumes and at a price that would rationalize the expenses within the model. And we did that through securing emissions reduction purchase agreements, or ERPAs, with a number of mainly corporate buyers, where they basically said, okay, if you produce this carbon credit at a defined price, we will buy it. And with those in hand, we were then able to go to underwriters working with Morgan Stanley and say, okay, we sort of have the demand locked in place. So that should justify us financing the activities to go out and market the program and enroll landowners and give them the financial and technical incentives, because we know on the back end, we'll be generating carbon credits that will allow us to service the bond.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also went through the additional step of officially labeling it as a green bond and having a third party with sort of standards related to it being truly green finance sort of look at it. And now that we've issued it, we have reporting requirements, not only to the bond buyers, but also to that third party who's sort of certifying, right, that this is a green bond.
Okay, time for a quick pause in the conversation to briefly explain a green bond. A bond is a financial instrument where an issuer, like a government, corporation, or organization, borrows money from investors. In return, the issuer promises to pay back the borrowed amount of money, known as the principal, along with periodic interest payments over a set period of time, which can range from a couple of years to a few decades. A green bond is a type of bond that uses the borrowed funds specifically for environmentally friendly projects. The proceeds from green bond issuances are used to finance projects with positive environmental impacts, such as renewable energy projects, sustainable infrastructure, and climate change initiatives, or, in the case of AFF's green bond, forest conservation. Investors who buy green bonds support these environmentally responsible projects while potentially receiving a financial return on their investment. All right, so that's the simple green bond gist. Let's get back to the conversation.
What I think made this different from other green bonds in this space or other conservation finance in general is that structure is pretty familiar to people. But typically, conservation finance is blending a number of revenues, right? So you might have someone buy a property, for example. That's what they need to issue the bond for, is to purchase the property. And then the way they're going to pay back the bond is a mixture of revenues. Yes, there could be carbon credits, but there could also be timber sales, and there could be hunting leases, and there could be the sale of an easement, right? And then there could be the eventual sale of the property back to another party. And all of that together creates the revenue that allows the organization to service the bond. For us, we were focused on only one type of revenue, and that was the revenue from carbon credit sales. And the reason why that's important in the family lands context is family landowners are not looking to get bought out by carbon developers.
Yeah.
They like their land. They have an emotional attachment to their land. They want to keep their land.
Exactly.
So it would not be a good intervention to buy up a whole bunch of family lands into a conglomerated carbon project. Instead, what you want to do is figure out what's the exchange with family landowners, where you're giving them some mixture of incentives and technical assistance. In exchange, they're giving you the right to the carbon credits that are produced through implementation of that assistance. And the sale of those carbon credits are what ultimately sort of fuel that machine. So that was the theory behind the green bond. We did have to secure it using AFF's own balance sheet. So to some extent, it was a big step forward, very innovative, and sort of demonstrating a new concept of how climate projects, natural climate solutions could be funded. On the other hand, it's not very scalable, because we, as AFF, will quickly run out of balance sheet to use to secure these bonds. So that is sort of the pathway for future innovations that we have to develop. And we have a lot of ideas on how to do that in order to enable that model to scale beyond the 10 million level, which, as listeners of your podcast will know, is trivially small for a bond issuance, right? To the scale that it needs to be at to really finance meaningful climate action of the scale that's so desperately needed by the planet right now.
Right. So as you said, the buyers of the credits were corporates primarily, and then you've already issued the bond. And so how have you guys gone along with actually putting the money to work? How is it being implemented?
Yeah, so we are using it in the Central Appalachians. So this is the states of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Maryland. To date, using largely the financing from the bond, although we do have funding from other sources as well. We've enrolled about 50,000 acres and about 350 landowners in that landscape in the program. And we still have a fair chunk of the bond left to fuel future enrollments. So I think in terms of validating that we can enroll landowners in the program, that's been good. We're just now going through our first monitoring, reporting, and verification cycle, and we haven't gone through the verification part of it. For those listeners who don't know the ins and outs of the carbon market, you know, you do some internal measurements first of the carbon impact according to the methodology you're using, and then you engage a third-party auditor who sort of checks your work effectively before you can answer carbon credit. So we've done the internal part. Now we're shifting over to the work with a third party. But that internal work, with that caveat, shows that there has been a significant climate benefit, actually a little bit more than we expected, to the landowners who've signed up so far in the program. So that's working. And we've encountered also challenges in this model. Number one, way harder to sign up landowners than we thought it was going to be. And that's because carbon markets are so foreign to landowners. It's very difficult.
So you had to go through a period of kind of like education for them?
Yep. And there's a lot of carbon programs out there. Some of them are carbon credit programs like ours that are producing high quality credits for the carbon market. Others are more charitably minded programs that are just kind of using carbon in the title. There's a lot of state programs. There's unclear overlaps with state tax policy in some cases. So there's just like a lot of stuff happening, and it takes landowners time to work through all of that information and come to decisions about their land. And in particular, we're asking them to make a commitment of at least 20 years, which is challenging for most individual landowners. So it's taken longer than we thought. That's one challenge. Mm-hmm. The second challenge actually is tied to the integrity, the quality of the credits that we're producing. We are using another first, which is the world's first dynamic baseline. That's the methodology that we use. Now, what does that mean? A dynamic baseline means that instead of doing a forest carbon project in the traditional way, the traditional way, just to spend a moment on it, is we measure the carbon that's in a forest, and then we build a model, an Excel spreadsheet, that predicts what would have happened to that the carbon in that forest over time were it not for the carbon project. That's the counterfactual or the baseline.
Yeah.
And however far our actual observations of forest carbon are above that baseline, that's how many credits we issue. The problem with that, two problems. Number one, very hard to predict the future, right? Even under the best of circumstances. And so when you're building these models with all these assumptions and they go out in time 30 years, you're almost guaranteed to get that wrong. You cannot possibly predict all the influences on forest carbon that should be incorporated in that baseline.
Yeah.
And then number two, as a project developer, you have an obvious incentive to include assumptions that are beneficial to you, like report that that baseline would be very low relative to the project scenario. Why? Because that will give you more credits to sell.
Exactly.
And by the way, that there aren't forest carbon developers who've like done this one or two times that are now on a yacht in Malta. I mean, forest carbon developers as a community are really devoted to this and are typically passing up other opportunities in the for-profit sector to try and implement this. So the incentive is not putting money in their own pockets. The incentive is to make projects work, to get work out there. But nonetheless, there have been a number of well-publicized instances where that's been inflated.
Right.
So a dynamic baseline changes that entirely. And the way we do it is we take our project that we've implemented and we compare it to a set of matched controls. So these are forest plots that are monitored by the federal government as part of its forest inventory analysis. And so for each plot that we have in our project, we match it to the 10 plots that look most similar to our plot according to a number of covariates. So this would be things like elevation or the slope of the land or the distance to a mill or the distance to a major road, forest type, obviously. And then now that we've created this match control, at time zero, there's no difference between our project scenario and that match control. We haven't generated any carbon credits. But as time goes on, we just simply observe what happens in our project and then what happens in that baseline. The two benefits of this are that baseline is dynamic. It will pick up whatever changes happen in forest products markets or the natural climate, natural disasters, development, so on and so forth. Even if we didn't assume those things were going to happen, the baseline will pick them up. And so that's more accurate. And then number two, there actually is no way for us to game that system, right? We don't know where those baseline plots are. We're not responsible for monitoring them. They're monitored by the federal government, not by us. And so our ability as a project developer with the best of intentions to sort of inflate numbers is effectively destroyed. So I swear this is related to finance, Jay, and I'm getting to it right now. That thing, that makes the carbon credit high quality because we know it is truly additional. The carbon that is created through the project is the result of the program itself, that technical and financial assistance we provide to landowners. It's not based on faulty assumption. That's great. But what it introduces into these projects is a high level of uncertainty. Because in the old model, we could tell you what the baseline was going to be. We knew. But in this model, we don't know what the baseline is going to be. So it's a guessing game as to how many credits we'll create in any one year. That level of risk makes it really difficult to finance these projects through sort of traditional bond mechanisms or other traditional finance vehicles. Because I don't need to tell you what investors or bond buyers, a word they're not crazy about is risk.
Yeah.
Another one, uncertainty. Another, dynamic. Another, variability. Like these are words they're not comfortable
right.
with. And so we've had to try and figure out ways to basically either manage that risk, reduce that uncertainty, or get really creative about who we can transfer it to in order to make this financing work.
Yeah. And just so that the listeners are clear, the methodology that you're referring to is VM45 that you guys had gotten approval with through VERA about also last year, I believe in 2022. And that's the methodology for improved forest management using dynamic matched baselines from national forest inventories. And so you hit the nail on the head that the kind of the ironic thing of using a dynamic baseline versus a static baseline is that the accuracy is better, but you run the risk of potentially, well, you're going to solve the issue of potentially overcrediting, but it just creates another issue of you can't predict the amount of credits. And that's exactly what you said. And so it's on one hand, the integrity goes up because the accuracy is much better, which is good from an environmental perspective. This is what we want. We want honesty and accuracy when it comes to how much carbon is going to be captured or stored. But in the financial side of the coin, it definitely creates troubles with predicting the amount of credits that are going to be generated. I would like to go back a little bit and talk about when you were assembling the bond. And I know that this was a challenge that you kind of talked about, but could you dive a little bit more into the challenge that you faced when you were assembling the bond guarantee? And as you had said, having to back it up from AFF's own ledger.
Yeah, I think what natural climate solutions really need to get to scale is the same kind of support that you'll find for other agricultural or forest commodities. And that's what a nature-based credit is. It's a commodity. It comes from a set of management decisions that are made that are subject to variability in a variety of ways. And so what you need is you need some entity to provide credit enhancement, or basically that guarantee that if the projections don't work out the way we've planned them, there will be recourse other than an investor just losing all of their money. Mm-hmm. So our initial theory was that that credit enhancement could be provided by the federal government. Why the federal government? A couple reasons. Number one, as I mentioned, they already do this, right? Through the Commodity Credit Corporation, they do it at a very large scale for other agricultural commodities. Number two, the benefits that accrue through these projects are largely public benefits. Yes, the landowners gain paid for the climate benefit, for the carbon sequestration and storage. But they're not getting paid for the clean water produced. They're not getting paid for the biodiversity values. They're not getting paid for the aesthetic or recreational values. Those accrue mainly to the public. And so the public has an interest. And third, the government is already subsidizing these values through grant programs to landowners, right? They're going out and they're paying landowners directly. The problem is they're doing it at a very small scale. If they can, instead of doing grants or as a supplement to grants, use bond and loan guarantees to de-risk these investments, we can bring in hundreds of millions, billions of dollars into natural climate solutions in the United States and scale them very rapidly. That was our theory at the time. We're still working on it. I think the federal government in a variety of forms is interested, but is just itself quite risk averse and also very slow moving.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, as we were working on that, we got to a point where we had to decide, you know, are we going to move forward with this bond or not? And the only way to move forward was for AFF to say, you know what, we do have some financial resources. We're lucky enough to have them. We're going to secure this first one just to demonstrate what happens when you offer that credit enhancement, because it was like a light switch flipping. It went from a bond that probably would not have been accepted in the marketplace unsecured to a bond that was oversubscribed when we issued it, just like that. The difference was the guarantee. And that's the case that we continue to make, not only to the federal government, also to philanthropies, major donors. If there's anyone out there listening who's like, I got $10 million, I wish there was something I could do, don't give it to an organization. Use it to guarantee loans or bonds, because you'll leverage that. You'll be able to have so much more impact through that mechanism. Although, I should say, as the fundraiser in me right now is screaming, like, we also wouldn't complain if you just gave it to people. That's also good. Yeah. So anyway, that's how we got that green bond off the ground. But without that source of credit enhancement, we or other project developers or other NGOs working in this space, where our capacity to deploy these projects is extremely limited. And so we really need to solve that problem of who is willing to at least co-own that risk with those of us who are working on the ground.
Who do you think actually, in your perspective, should bear the responsibility for that risk? Is that coming from the forest carbon project developer, or would it be the buyer?
I mean, I think there's a couple areas. There's basically four options, right? So the one we're using right now is the is us, project developer. And there's some benefit in that in the sense that we probably know the most about the project. So we probably have the most information about the risk and are also probably best suited to manage it. So that's a benefit. The downside is just there's no project developer in the world who's capitalized at anywhere near the level they would need to be to bring any of this work to scale.
Yeah.
If we're the only ones holding the risk. Another one that could own some of the risk is the landowner. And larger carbon projects don't have this problem because the landowner owns the risk and the upside associated with the project. But that's not going to work for family landowners. And by the way, family landowners are relevant not only in the United States, but globally. 2/3 or 3/4 of commodities come from smallholders across the globe. So this isn't just a U.S. problem. If we do not figure out how to get these people involved in climate finance and projects, we're not going to succeed in activating natural climate solutions at scale. When you think about that smallholder, they do not have the luxury of being able to wait 5, 10, 15 years for a return on the investment. And so they need a guaranteed income stream. They're willing to sacrifice that upside in exchange for certainty that they can sort of plan on and they can use to secure the things that are most important to them. So landowners won't work. I've already talked about the government or third parties owning it. I think that ultimately has to be the solution at scale because of the public values. But in the interim, there's a fourth group that I feel very strongly needs to step up, and that is the buyers themselves, the corporations. Of all the stakeholders, they're the ones who most desperately need these units, these carbon credits to be produced, and they need it in order to fulfill their net zero commitments and demonstrate to their investors that their business model is fundamentally sustainable in a world where the cost of burning fossil fuels will continue to rise, right? That's the job of the voluntary carbon market, is to give companies a mechanism to provide assurance to their investors that their business model is going to persist over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
Without carbon credits, they're not going to be able to provide that assurance. So they need them. They need them desperately. And we are on track to produce a very small fraction of the number of credits that are going to be needed by those companies. And the reason is because of this catch-22 that we're in. Without the capital to implement these projects, we can't create a track record. We can't demonstrate their ability to deliver. But because we haven't been able to do that, the projects are risky. What companies can do, we believe, is enter earlier in on the process in a catalytic way through what we call an advanced market commitment. So this is basically when a company prepays for carbon credits to be delivered later. And rather than just agreeing on a price and a number of credits, what a company can do is they can cover a share of the project's expenses and thus become effectively an equity investor at the project level. So to make it really simple, if you cover 50% of the project expenses, you're going to get 50% of the credit yield. Now, yes, you are taking on the risk of underperformance, but oh, by the way, you're also getting the upside of project overperformance, which also happens, right? And so we think that this is a really equitable, effective, and catalytic way for companies to get involved, to make sure that they do have those credits that they're going to be depending on, and to sort of get us to a bigger scale, a platform of stability. And then we think that some of those more risk-averse actors like governments are going to be more willing to come in and offer the credit enhancement that allows us to get to the scale we need to get to if we're going to do our part in fighting the climate crisis.
Got it. So you're of the opinion, just so I can sum this up, is that for the corporates to come in almost as like a limited partner early on in the project, and that would be their way of shouldering the risk versus them just simply purchasing X amount of credits for X amount of money at the very end of it.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I think you're seeing this shift happen in other sectors as we go through this transition. I was reading in the New York Times the story about Ford and General Motors essentially getting into the mining business because there's not enough lithium for the batteries they need for their electric cars, right?
So exactly.
5 years ago, they could have just written an RFP, taken bids, had a contract. Now they've realized the infrastructure, the capacity, the financial resources does not exist within the ecosystem of mining companies to service their needs. So they're going to have to do something. It's a very, very similar dynamic when it comes to natural climate solutions.
Yeah, it's essentially the Tesla approach of controlling your entire value chain from top to bottom. And so now you guys are about a year into the bond being issued, and you'd said that you have enrolled landowners, although you still have a lot of space for more, and they're already initiating some of the activities. Of course, as you kind of touched on earlier, carbon credits work in a crediting period. And so do you have any sense of when the first batch of credits will be issued?
Yeah, we should have our first issuance next year. And I need to acknowledge that that's 2 years behind schedule. One thing I've learned from my time in the carbon markets, because of all these capacity constraints that we've been talking about, anytime someone says, oh, it'll take us a year, just 3x that, it'll take them three. And that's going to persist until we solve these financing challenges and we can really bring the capacity required to do these projects at scale. But then after our first issuance next year, we're going to try and have another issuance the following year, and then we'll go on to 5-year cycles. And the reason we do that is it's just the transaction costs of going through verification cycle are very high.
Yeah.
So the more that you can space those out, the sort of easier it is for the model to stomach.
Absolutely. Great. I mean, that was awesome, Nate. I appreciate all of that. And I think that a huge part of what the work you're doing is actually VM45. And I am very much looking forward to VM45 being utilized more, hopefully not just in the US, but in other places, because I do believe in my heart of hearts that the dynamic baseline does provide a lot more accuracy and integrity and creates this high quality credit in the end, despite the fact that it is a little bit more difficult to predict versus a static baseline of how many credits you're going to produce. Do you have any sense of if VM45 is being utilized by other companies or developers anywhere?
Yeah, I do. And actually, before saying that, I do just want to acknowledge VM45 was the work of three organizations, us at AFF, the Nature Conservancy, and then Terra Carbon. And they all contributed a ton of work. But in particular, the core idea comes from Terra Carbon. So I just want to give them a shout out. I don't want to leave anyone with the impression that AFF had this moment of brilliance. We are standing on the shoulders of giants here.
Yeah, appreciate that.
But to answer your question, I am aware of other projects that have started to use the dynamic baseline. And I'm aware of a lot of inquiries that have come from other countries that do have the appropriate forest inventories to be able to utilize the dynamic baseline. I will, to return to this financing challenge, the whole carbon market sort of feels like a game of whack-a-mole, where you're like, okay, additionality, that's the big problem. So we put all our brain power to that, we whack that one, and now we have the financing challenge that pops up. And I guarantee you, when we solve that one, there'll be some other problem that pops up through that solution. That's all part of the cycle of getting better. And it's important that all of us in this community lean in to the difficulty and complexity of improving over time. The reason I mention that is when we put VM45 out for public comment, a lot of the comments we got back were, this is great, but it can't be implemented. It's way too difficult to implement because of these issues. And so I think we've discovered that there's a lot of truth to that. It's really hard to make it work for all the stakeholders involved, but it's worth the effort because at the end of the day, why are we in this? We're in this because the atmosphere has to feel a difference. So that has to be the starting point. And if that creates a lot of complexity, so be it. We got to chase that complexity down and figure out solutions to it.
Absolutely. So Nate, I want to kind of look towards the future a second. And so when you were envisioning where AFF is going, what kind of climate finance tools do you anticipate utilizing a little bit more of? Do you think you'll continue down this green bond path? Or are you going to try and go back into your philanthropic roots, or also just leaning more into the carbon credit space?
So our current strategic plan is aimed at putting family lands, this entire area, on a pathway to produce 1 billion tons of climate mitigation by 2050. That's sort of our estimate of what is ours to do. It's worth saying, is that going to solve climate change? No. But is it one of 500 interventions that added all together can keep us on a 1.5 or 2-degree pathway? Yes. And so our view is this is ours to do. This is our piece of the puzzle that we got to solve. So how are we going to do that? We AFF are not going to produce 1 billion tons of climate mitigation. What we're focused on is demonstrating a model to produce high quality climate mitigation that can be implemented by others. And because that's our focus, we're often hesitant to rely too much on philanthropy. Because again, if you rely a lot on philanthropy to make it work, that's great, you made it work, but then can that be replicated by the next organization? There is a role for philanthropy. There is a role for government grants in the learning phase as to sort of de-risk things, to allow us to make a mistake here or there and learn from that mistake. And we certainly rely on that. But overall, the market we are going to rely on for 90 to 95% of this is the sale of voluntary carbon credits. And then the question is, how do you bridge the gap between today, where you have all these expenses of landowner engagement and practice implementation, and 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, when you're actually producing and monetizing the credits? And so there, we have two main mechanisms. One is the issuance of debt, for which we need credit enhancement. So we're always interested in issuing debt, and we're always dependent on credit enhancement. And while we don't have any, like, we have no more of our own that we can deploy at this point, so the debt issuances are on pause for that reason. That's avenue one. And avenue two is this notion of buyer financing that I talked about, which is really trying to get corporates more involved in the early stages of this project. It's a win-win situation in my mind, because the projects win, we get the finance we need to implement this and grow, and the corporates win because they secure a place at the front of the line in what is going to be a very crowded ecosystem come 2035, 2040, when these interim net zero targets start to hit. If I could give one piece of advice to any corporate sustainability people listening, you do not want to be the person who wakes up to this in 2034 and is trying to buy carbon credits on the spot market in 2035. That is going to be ugly. So yeah, anyway, to answer your question, those are the two main mechanisms that we see to fund this project, with a little bit of philanthropy and grants sprinkled in, particularly in these early years, to kind of get the machine up and running.
You know, as you were saying that, I started to think about the credit enhancement, and I feel like there is a role for some entity or some group to kind of come in and fill that credit enhancement space, specifically when it's tied to conservation efforts or restoration efforts. And so you're kind of giving me a little bit of a brainchild to go back and have a conversation with Sean, our CEO, about this, because I do think that that's something that's going to come up again and again. And, you know, we've spoken about it now in just this last 45 minutes multiple times. So as you said, you know, the government could be that person, but there does need to be someone else in the meantime to kind of fill that position. And I think that there's space for that.
I totally agree. And Sean and I have talked about this. You know, could the 10 largest philanthropies in the United States, foundations, all take a trivial percentage of their endowments, 1%, and throw it all in a pool together and unlock massive climate progress? Yes, they could, right? That would probably more or less solve that problem.
Yeah.
Could the 10 biggest buyers of carbon credits say, you know what, we're going to throw in $25 million a piece, not as a grant, but into this pool to unlock this finance and create this carbon credits? Yes, that would be another way to solve it. Ultimately, people are going to have to do things differently. They're going to have to motivate capital and take some risks that they haven't taken in the past in order to get the conservation outcomes they want. If instead they're just going to wait for the conservation community, all of us little NGOs chugging away in our own little corners of the country, to bootstrap our way to scale, I think they're going to be disappointed with the outcome.
Yeah, that's a huge effort. So, Nate, we're about ready to wrap up. And during the pre-production part of this podcast, Sean and I were talking about how we would like to close out each episode. And he and I are both pretty big fans of the philosophical school of thought, Stoicism. And so we're going to introduce a question to each guest at the end. And so you have the privilege of being the very first to participate. Epictetus, who was a very big Stoic philosopher, he once stated, "What concerns me is not the way things are, but the way people think things are." And so I want to apply this perspective to climate finance and ask you the question of, what do you think is the one thing we absolutely need to do to change the way people think about climate finance?
What a great question. Also, you're really testing that classical studies part of my major.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I think the one thing that I would change is I would ask all of my friends and colleagues in the finance community to remember that when we talk about variability, that's the thing that is actually happening in the world, is that outcomes are different than what we predicted. In the finance community, the word that gets used to describe variability is risk. But that is one half of the coin of variability. And the other half is that you could overperform, right? You could do more than you expected. You could do more than you wanted. And it's an odd feature of conservation finance and finance in general that there is not more willingness to take risks to discover what that upside is. And people are so over-indexed to the risks and the downsides. That is particularly important in this moment in time because we've run out of time to only take the safe bets on the issue of climate change. We have got to take every bet we can, regardless of the odds. And so that would be the one thing that I would want people to change is just to remember there's risk and there's reward. A little boldness, I think, is required.
That was good. Let's be bold. I appreciate that. Absolutely. Well, Nate, I also appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us today. This was a great, great conversation. I hope you also had some fun.
Oh, it was great. Yeah, really, really appreciated it.
Excellent. Well, thank you, sir. And that wraps up today's episode. Thanks for tuning in. I'll be back next month with a conversation with one of my favorite people, the talented and impressive Paula DiPerna. We'll chat about her recently published book, Pricing the Priceless, and about her experiences as a bona fide pioneer in the voluntary and compliance carbon markets. If you want to connect, you can shoot me an email at jtipton@gordianknotstrategies.com. A link to my email address is in the show notes. And if you're interested in joining me for an episode, or if you have someone else in mind, I'd be happy to talk. Finally, please be sure to subscribe and leave a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Catch you all next time.